Welcome to the Euro Digital Partners Insights podcast. I'm Sean Patterson. I'm happily joined by another Thunderbird graduate, Jesse Randall, CEO of Sweater and co-founder of Guidely.
Good morning. How are you?
Jesse was at the Thunderbird School of Global Management after I was and joins us today from Boulder, Colorado. So, Jesse, a warm welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So, Jesse, I'll ask you the same question I ask all the Thunderbirds that I have on this program. And this is for those listeners interested in business school programs. What took you to Thunderbird?
Oh, geez. Thunderbird was like a love affair for me. I found out about Thunderbird when I was in my undergrad. And I had lived abroad for a couple of years doing some nonprofit work. And as soon as I found out about Thunderbird, it just struck a chord with me. I knew I was going to go on and do graduate work anyway. And as soon as I found out that I could focus in international business and have more of a multicultural approach to understanding the world and understanding how business fits into the broader global context, I absolutely fell in love. So I was pretty much just waiting 3 years to get through undergrad and get through some outside work experience to be able to go in and take advantage of it. So I was probably a pretty easy conversion for those recruiters at Thunderbird.
Yeah, I bet. But I'm wondering, had you had the opportunity in undergrad or even in high school to do some study abroad? I mean, I think you're right. It is important to have that multicultural sort of education and experience.
Yeah, so I did before Thunderbird. So I had I served a 2-year volunteer mission, I guess you would call it, for my religious organization in Mexico. So I was there for 2 full years. I got dumped in not knowing any Spanish at all. I had about a 6-week training course and then was dumped into the middle of nowhere in Puebla, Mexico. And I started just servicing people in very small communities, pueblitos, they call them. And I fell in love with a different culture and with an amazing, very generous people that lived there. And it was awesome. Totally changed my worldview. And then later, I had the opportunity to do an internship in Brussels, Belgium for a summer during my undergrad, which was awesome. It was a very, it was exceptionally multicultural because I was working for an Israeli family in Brussels and all of their clients were outside the European Union. So our clients were global.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it was also very entrepreneurial, which kind of led me into the career that I've had in that this Israeli family was running about 7 businesses and I was helping with all of them. So it was amazing to be in this very entrepreneurial minded household, really. We literally worked in a house in Brussels. Huh. And it totally got me I got bitten by the international bug and by the entrepreneurial bug all at once.
I guess quite a lot of Thunderbirds have some sort of language education. What's your language background? Are you an English only Thunderbird, or do you have some? It sounds like you learned quite a bit of Spanish. Did you learn during high school as well? Or what's your language background?
So I do speak Spanish. I'm a little rustier than I used to be, but hablo español.
Okay, fantástico.
Yeah. So, I got dumped into Mexico not knowing anything. But within about 6 months, I could communicate with just about anybody about most things. It wasn't very good. After about a year, I was fluent. And then 2 years in, I was pretty close to sounding like a native. You have to live somewhere for a long time to really get that good. So I wouldn't presume that I'm that good. But at the time, I was very fluent.
It sounds like you have a knack for it.
I survived.
And what's your involvement with Thunderbird today?
Well, besides being an alumnus, I do try to stay involved. I volunteer fairly regularly. I actually just volunteered 2 weeks ago? Was that last week? No, it was 10 days ago for the Thunderbird Business Plan Competition as one of the judges.
Oh, cool. Yeah, very awesome.
So that was fun, right? I actually took part in the same business plan competition when I was at Thunderbird, so it was fun to go back. But I help where I can. I try to go to First Tuesdays when I travel and wherever
Absolutely.
I'm living. I don't get out as much as I would like to or as consistency as I would like to, but I do try to take advantage of being a Thunderbird.
And you live in Boulder, Colorado now, right?
That's right. Yeah, I've been here for about a year.
Okay. And it's like, what's the community there like? Is there one?
Yeah, there is one. Yeah, I've actually I've met up with several T-Birds. I'm probably connected with, 100 T-Birds here. I haven't met them all, but I'm pretty prolific on LinkedIn. So I'm connected with at least 100 T-Birds across Colorado.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It's a great community. Yeah, it's a great community. And I need to make it out more. Last year, at least for the last several years, they've had a ski weekend because it's Colorado, right? And I just barely missed the one last year because I had to travel last minute.
Okay.
And I don't know if they're going to do it this year or not, but I'd like to make that one happen.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Well, if not this year, I guess maybe next year. I mean, everything's a bit up in the air these days.
It is a little weird.
You later ended up in venture capital, but before we get to that, it does sound like if you're participating in a business plan competition, it sounds like you're very entrepreneurial minded. I'm just kind of curious, though, what kind of investment and entrepreneurship education did you get from Thunderbird? Perhaps you can speak to that.
Yeah, sure. So Thunderbird had, I would say I got exposure in two ways. The only explicit class that I took was entrepreneurial finance. It was from Professor Gibbons, who did a fantastic job. And the class itself was really focused, I mean, entrepreneurially, it was more for like late stage venture, you know, companies that are doing 10 million, 20 million plus in annual recurring revenue.
Okay.
And so that the finance was really set in that context. So, you know, you have operating history and, you know, things are very volatile, but you're trying to run projections into the future and do cash flow analysis and all this stuff. But it, that laid a foundation for me to apply that entrepreneurial finance mindset to early stage venture when you don't have any operating history, but you still need to run projections for the business. And that's really become a core skill set of who I am and what I bring to the table in the entrepreneurial community is that entrepreneurial finance. So that was a critical one for me that I've been able to adapt. The other one is really from being an entrepreneur as a student. It's kind of funny because I came out of my undergrad having pursued an entrepreneurial idea that we don't have to get into, but it totally got crushed by the financial crisis in 2008, 2009.
All right. Give us 10 seconds of what it was.
So it actually stemmed out of that experience I had in Brussels.
Okay.
And the idea was European companies can't hire Americans because, well, it's difficult because of paperwork, like especially American interns.
Right.
And so what the value prop was, we will create an American company. You tell us who you want to hire as interns. We'll go find them, hire them to work for us, and then effectively create a consulting relationship between our American entity and yours. And we'll send that person to go work for you. And then it's a contract instead of having to have all the paperwork.
And
by the time we figured out how to actually pitch that, the financial crisis hit and nobody wanted to hire Americans. So,
yeah.
But anyway, that's the 10-second version. It was great foundation, cool. But I came into Thunderbird saying, I'm not going to do another entrepreneurial thing because I'm about to take on a ton of debt and I need to focus and go get a corporate job.
Right.
And I lasted for about 6 months before I got sucked into another entrepreneurial venture, but it was very good for me. And I took it through that business plan competition. I ended up winning a $20,000 grant from a big global environmental consulting firm that wanted me to flesh it out and pursue it some more. And that was great. I had several professors that were instrumental in helping me to craft that approach inside that company and really try to make the most of it. And I did all that the second half of my time at Thunderbird.
So how did you end up in venture capital? Sounds like you were on a very entrepreneurial route.
Yeah, well, that was a funny thing. So when I stumbled into entrepreneurship when I was in my undergrad, I didn't even know what it was. Like, you didn't have Shark Tank. You know, Silicon Valley really wasn't that sexy yet. You know, it was,
yeah, for sure.
It was like, if you were in the industry, you knew about it, but it wasn't mainstream.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I kind of stumbled into it. And I didn't think that you could work in venture capital in the industry and of startups without being a founder. I thought that was the only way to do it.
Yeah, I had the same impression, actually. So yeah, it totally passed me by as well. So I completely understand.
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't realize that there was this whole world of supporting startups. And I kind of fell into it on accident. I had a hard time getting a job coming out of school because I was focused on clean tech. And this was in 2011, 2012. And the clean tech industry was totally collapsing around this time because of the Solyndra scandal and a bunch of other stuff that was going on. And I couldn't land a job, which I was super disappointed at. And another T-Bird actually referred me to a company called Tallwave that's in Scottsdale. And they're basically at the beginning edge of the accelerator movement.
Sure.
You know, because like in the 2005 to 10 range, it was all about incubators. And in the 2010 to 2015 range, there was this big boom of accelerators, which was a little different. And they were building one.
Yep.
And so they invited me to come on board and help. And I ended up being the director of all their operations there. And I actually built a version of Techstars effectively. And I ran three or four cohorts when I was there. through that program. And I was at the beginning of their process of actually building a venture fund while I was there. I didn't raise that fund, but I was conducting the due diligence for the companies that were coming through. The fund was sponsoring this very specific accelerator program. And
sure,
that's kind of how I fell into it. But it was a T-Bird actually that introduced me in.
Yeah, I think I must have met you somewhere around that time.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, like, what's your opinion having done that route? Do you recommend it for other MBAs? I mean, what's the trick to getting in, and what do you like and dislike about it?
Oh, trick to getting in. You know, I've actually, it's always intrigued me reading other people's opinions about how to get into the industry.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So like whenever I see those, I like to read them because I kind of laugh, right? Sort of the general understanding, you know, it's like the unspoken standard in the industry is that if you don't come from a tier A school, like, you know, Stanford or Harvard or, you know, NYU or whatever.
Sure.
Or if you don't have someone wealthy, not necessarily wealthy, but someone who's already in the industry that will open the door and give you cred,
right,
then you really can't get in. It's not impossible, but it is so extraordinarily competitive if you haven't had your foot in somewhere else. So, I mean, in terms of getting in, it's if you don't have those kind of connections already or that kind of street cred walking into it, you're going to have a very hard time breaking into venture capital. If you want to work for an actual VC firm, and be inside that part of the ecosystem, it's difficult to do. And you call that like the center of the ecosystem, right? Actually working for a fund. And then like the level two around it would be like, you know, working for accelerators and programs that support entrepreneurial ecosystems and things like that. Those are much, much easier to get into. I mean, easy is relative. You still have to be qualified.
Sure.
But there's also not as much money there.
Okay.
And so it's not like you're going to make a ton of money working for an accelerator. You know, they're
right.
Accelerators are often government funded, you know, or they're like a branch of a VC fund and it's more a deal flow mechanism.
Yep.
You know, so there may not be a lot of money associated with it because it's viewed in that light.
Yeah, I think that's how it is in the EU as well. I think it's seen as a sort of feeder into and future investment.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, getting into that second tier, it does give you some credibility to get into the first tier, but it's definitely not a guarantee. So it's basically, I guess the short answer there is it's hard. And I would even say, argue that myself, I don't know that I'm even all the way in yet. You know, it's hard to get like deep into the industry and
sure,
and have the credibility to truly say, I am a venture capitalist. And this is, you know, I move money, I make investments, you know, I'm at the top of the hill, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. So, I mean, like eventually you decided, okay, I've had enough of this. I guess you decided what to get more entrepreneurial or less. I mean, what's the what happened to precipitate the change out of Tollwave?
Yeah, you know, I kind of boil it down to the idea that you can only build other people's dreams for so long,
sure,
before you get your own.
Yep.
You know, I counted before I left. I was somewhere around 120 companies that I had worked very intimately with when I was at Tollwave.
Wow.
And eventually, you just get to a place where, you know, you have your own thing. And that's what happened to me. You know, I had something on the kind of the back burner, working on nights and weekends for about a year before I left there. And I tried to pursue it. And despite all my experience there helping other companies, I still made many, many mistakes coming out of that. And I burned through a lot of personal resources and ended up deciding to start doing consulting and working more closely with other companies. So I've got one thing about me is I've got a bunch of kids. So I have some obligations that I have to meet regularly.
Right.
It puts a lot of pressure on, right, to make sure that you can provide. And so I got to a point where I couldn't just hang out and keep pushing on this company anymore. So I put it on the shelf and went to work for someone else and ended up getting into consulting and ended up building a lead generation agency and still working with companies to help them, you know, build pitch decks and, you know, build out their financials and help them to get through the hardest stages, which are right at the beginning. And so I did that for years.
But now you've moved into, it sounds like you've got two sort of, I guess, gigs going on. One is Guidely and the other is a Sweater VC. So what led you to creating those? What's the impetus?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a brief intro how I got to Sweater, and we can talk more about it later because that's my main focus. And then we'll talk about Guidely for a minute. So Sweater came first, and that really came out of the idea of wanting to actually start a micro VC fund. As I got into it, I recognized how somewhat ridiculous it was that retail investors can't put money into a VC fund.
Indeed.
I knew that going into it. I mean, it's pretty common knowledge, you know, but the more I got into it, the more it bugged me. And the more, you know, you get into raising a fund, the more you kind of sense how, I don't want to say rigged the system is, but it's set in a very specific way. And if you don't fit in the mold, it's very difficult for you to raise a fund. And so
because ordinarily, if you want to invest in a company, they want you to be a qualified investor, which has a special denotation.
Exactly. At least in the qualified US. Or accredited. And so I got to the point where I said, anyone should be able to put money into a VC fund. What's the big deal? And I started digging, and we came up with a framework that we're going through a process with the SEC right now to get that approved for. And that's just been it's a very slow moving train trying to navigate that process. So that started first a couple of years ago, and I'm still working on it.
Okay.
So, at the end of the day, the purpose of that is to open up the venture capital asset class to retail investors or to regular people, however you want to call that. So we're working on it, and we're actually very close to having something that we can run with. So that's the basis of Sweater. And I started that about 2 years ago. And then Guidely started about a year ago. And I began consulting with a private equity guy that I got in touch with. And I started consulting on some of his projects. And one of the ones that we vetted was this idea of Guidely, which is, at the end of the day, it's kind of like a combination of Fiverr and Match.com to match you with coaches that are a good fit for you.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's all around kind of like spiritual personal development is the specific niche that it's in. So it's not just any business coaching, but it's like personal development.
Ah, okay. Gotcha.
And so I worked with him on that for quite a while, and he invited me to come in and be a co-founder and to help get that off the ground. And that's going to be launching here in the next month or so. So that one's very close. It's not a lot of barriers to prevent it from happening besides the technology. So like right now we've got about 100 of these guides or coaches already vetted. They've got profiles on the platform, and we're just finalizing a few details to be able to start bringing in the public.
Ah, okay. So how does it work? Like, what's the market sizing like for that? I'm trying to even wrap my head around that kind of niche.
Yeah. So, I mean, generally the personal development space is about a $10 billion a year industry. When you think about, books and conferences, retreats and, all that kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
So, and then there's really three levels within it. So the first level is like, buy a book, get inspired, read 7 Habits for Highly Effective People, choose to make some changes in your life, right? Next level is a little more involved. You go to see Tony Robbins in person, or you go to a week retreat to get away from your phone and, plan your life or whatever, right?
Yeah.
In both those instances, you are left to your own devices after you read the book or go to the event, right? And it's up to you to change yourself. The third level is where you get a personal coach, or we call them guides, right? That you actually work with very intimately, one-on-one. You might meet once a week for an hour or two, and they actually hold your hand to help you make a transformation over a period of time. And that's the market that we play in.
Ah, I see.
So
okay.
It's very fragmented. There's no central place to go and find a guide or a coach. It's pretty much word of mouth.
And is it a US centric thing? Because I imagine a lot of my listeners in the EU will be thinking, I've never heard of this before.
Oh, no.
I don't think it's as common here as it is maybe in the US.
Yeah, I think it depends. It may not be called as much coaching, but about 20% of the guides that we have on the platform right now are outside the United States.
Oh, okay.
We have a bunch from Israel. Yeah, we've got some in the EU, Iceland, South Africa. We've got a bunch, and we're just scratching the surface. So it's definitely out there. Coaching as a thing may not be as common, but this is more like personal life kind of coaching stuff. So
I see. Okay. So now you're in your life, you're kind of walking the line between operator and, I guess, investor in a way. I'm just wondering, what are you finding? What's the better place to be?
Good question. I am a sucker for building stuff. I don't know that I could ever 100. Well, I eat my own words. I like building. I like the ideation process. I like the creation process. So to the extent that I am involved in that and helping build real stuff, then I am happy personally. I have friends that are GPs at funds who don't really want to be the operators. Their passion is identifying good deals and being helpful in the process, but not really being the process, right? And defining the process,
sure,
being in the middle
of
it. I find that I like to have my hands dirty, So even with Sweater, at the end of the day, we consider ourselves a fintech company that happens to operate in the venture capital world, right? We don't consider ourselves a fund first.
Ah, okay. A key difference.
And there's a bunch of reasons for that, but we consider ourselves a startup.
Ah, okay. Okay. That's a very different way of thinking about it.
Well, and I can tell you more about it too. We, you know, about the technology behind it more than just the fund idea, which we haven't really talked about.
Yeah. Well, so I'm wondering from the founder side, what kind of advice might you give first time founders? Because you've done it a few times now. You've probably got some great experience. I imagine there are a few things that you, if you were to do it again for the first time, you'd be like, oh yeah, I really want to make sure I know this. Like, what's on that list for you?
Oh my gosh. How many mistakes have I made? Holy cow. It's a long list. I mean, here's the thing that I've both experienced myself and that I see gets missed most often. And that is truly understanding how your offering or your company, your value proposition, whatever you want to call it, how it really fits into your target customer's world. Because it's so easy to project yourself into someone else's world and say, oh, look at these problems that you're having, right? Or like, look at this market and how they're suffering. And here's my idea and I'm going to relieve the suffering, right? And it's so easy to just project that solution out into the world.
Sure.
Without truly understanding that position of those people in whatever it is you're doing. So it's always people. It doesn't matter if you're B2B, B2C, you know, if you're doing direct consumer stuff or whatever, right? There's always a person on the other side. And having like too much of an assumption that you understand their world kills more startups than anything else, right? Like I just commented on somebody's thread on LinkedIn the other day. They, you know, there's this common survey that's done that says, you know, these are the top 10 reasons startups fail. First one is didn't find product market fit. Second one is ran out of money. Third one is whatever, right? I'm like, really? You take all of these other ones that aren't number one and they all stem back to not having product market fit. You ran out of money because you didn't find product market fit.
Because you didn't find, yeah, exactly.
You know, or you ran out of money because, I think the third one is because like, not good founding team or something. You ran out of money because your team mismanaged it and you're not good at operating, right? I mean, you know, because you didn't have product market fit or whatever, right? Like it all goes back to something. And so the notion of product market fit is elusive, right? It's very difficult to find. And I think that with as much as we talk about it, it's, in my opinion, it's underplayed how important it is to narrow in and truly have your customer telling you that you found it. And the only way that they can tell you is by purchasing your product. And so you've just, if I were to have one piece of advice, it's you have to spend more time in their shoes and you don't count. Even if you're your own target audience, you don't count. You can't rely on your own experience to drive what the ultimate consumer is going
to
do.
Yeah, I have to agree with you.
Even if you know, have the same makeup and profile.
Yeah.
You know, because you're internally, you're just, you're biased. There's no other way to say it. You're just biased.
Indeed. Indeed.
So it's putting as much emphasis on that as possible, getting your product out in other people's hands way before you think it's ready. And letting them give you feedback and then you craft it around what you get back from them. I think that's the biggest thing, you know, and half of that, frankly, is timing.
Mm, that's true.
Right. You can't buy timing. And, you know, you look at something like Zoom, you know, like, I mean, Zoom was founded, you know, 10, 12 years ago, whatever, but, you know, and they did well when they went public a year ago, but man, look at what's happened since, you know, they were in the right place at the right time to blow every other solution out of the water when COVID hit. And you can't buy that. You know, so and there are other companies I've been working with this last year that also have had great timing.
Yeah, the timing is so important. And I'm just wondering, is it something that you can kind of create the timing? Or, I mean, I don't know how you would say, and maybe you have some ideas, but how would you say to a first-time entrepreneur, look at this company, the way that they approach market fit is really good. Are there examples out there that you can be like, yeah, they really know how to find that target?
Well, like a recent example of who's done a good job of that. So there's a company.
I don't just mean once, but I mean like again and again, you know, something where they seem to have a process in place. They're clearly, you know, they know where the center of the dartboard is.
Well, you know, as much as probably half the listeners will hate me for saying this, and it's maybe not as applicable because they're so big, but I mean, you look at Apple,
okay,
and Apple does a very good job of understanding what customers really want. And the reason that they're so good at it is because they're good at articulating and creating things that you don't understand that you even want yet. That's part of what makes Apple magical.
Right.
You know, at least in the past, right? Today, in my opinion, they've been pretty stagnant for a few years.
Yep.
But, you know, that 2005 to 2015 timeframe, you know, they were very good at figuring out what people really desired inside without them being able to articulate it. And that is magic, right? The ability to do that and to connect those dots is extraordinarily difficult, but it's also something that's, you know, driven as much by gut feel and other things, you know, and I don't know, Apple's also unfair because of resources, right?
But sure, of course.
I guess we don't have to tear that whole thing down, but they're very good at it. You know, I think, you know, another one that was a good fit, I like to point to Robinhood, right? Robinhood, maybe for those that aren't as familiar, if we're talking about you listeners, Robinhood is a mobile app that allows you to trade stocks for free here in the United States, at least. I don't know how available they are internationally. But they were absolutely groundbreaking.
I think mainly US.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're absolutely groundbreaking when they launched in 2014. You know, they got 1 million subscribers in under 6 months. And within 3 years of launch, you had all the other big trading platforms that were doing like $7 and $10 trades dropping down to zero because Robinhood was taking all their customers. All their deal flow was falling through the floor. And it was a very simple concept, right? We just want you to be able to trade for free, to trade on your phone, and to have it be stupid simple. And they did it, and it was perfect. You know, they've got 10 million users now. You know, I think their last valuation was 10 or 12 billion, if I'm not mistaken. And they've done extraordinarily well with a very simple, very straightforward concept where they were not trying to mimic any other player in the space. And they did a really good job.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I was thinking about going to a brokerage firm like Merrill Lynch. I flirted with this idea for, I think, 2 weeks after business school. And you know, I guess I should say, going back to your, you know, analysis of Apple, maybe I should have stayed there because I actually was at Apple before I went to Thunderbird. And I think it
I remember
was
that.
A
yeah, I'd forgotten you had been there.
Going back. yeah, but, you know, I think, well, it's water under the bridge now. But I think you're right about it because, you know, I was thinking about that market, how complicated it was just to trade a single, to make one trade. You'd have to like call somebody up and then they would have to place the trade if you could even get a hold of them straight away. If they weren't there, then like you'd have to leave a message with their secretary. It's like this whole crazy way of accessing the markets. And you just know this is not sustainable in the long term.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So especially once we got to this era where people were able to do so much from their mobile phone with the advent of the smartphone. Mm-hmm. Again, Apple, you know, like this is, you know, that it's happening. Yeah. So that one is, I think, a really good example because it's clearly filling a niche.
Yeah. Well, and let me give an example, you know, and I guess that's very intimate to me with Sweater, right? In terms of the timing story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a level deeper on Sweater. Sweater is going to be launched as a mobile app first, much like Robinhood, right? So you'll be able to come into the app and you'll be able to say, hey, I want to put in whatever, $2,500. And then sign up for putting in another $100 a month. And, you know, you can manage that subscription and, you know, and see your holding within the fund and everything else directly within that app. Very straightforward, very simple. You don't have to go talk to anybody else or whatever. And then within that experience, we'll also report back on the portfolio companies that are actually being invested in.
Okay.
So, because we believe, our belief is that you know, if you're putting in $2,500, investing into VC is not going to make you rich, right? Over the course of 10 years, that 2,500 sure. might turn into 7,500 or maybe 10,000, right? But you're not rich because of that, right? So,
right. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So, you know, we view it as this is as much an entertainment factor as it is an investment opportunity, you know? So it's kind of like, you know, everybody's watching the NBA at home on TV, you know, and it's a good experience or whatever. But what we're effectively saying is, hey, we're going to give you courtside seats and you're a part owner of the team. Come sit right here and watch the game is effectively what we're telling people. And if they win, you win, right? And so we'll report back on all the companies that are being invested in and, you know, really have something that you can chat about on the weekends with your friends and have an experience. But as it applies to timing, right, there are a few things that timing-wise are very important for us right now that would not have been possible 10 years ago. So first is that, you know, cell phone or smartphone market penetration is super high, right? We could not have done this if we had been a web browser first solution. It would not have been appealing enough. We couldn't have provided the experience required to have done this 10 years ago. The ability to go direct to consumer with advertising is also extraordinarily important. Again, 10 years ago, we couldn't have driven down the cost per acquisition enough to have made the math work it would not have been possible unless you'd already had established channels. If you were Merrill Lynch or Charles Schwab, maybe they could have done it 10 years ago, but definitely not, okay. not as a startup. Yeah. And then, you know, regulatory and basic market openness over the last 10 years has changed dramatically in the mindset that maybe retail investors are ready to actually put money into this riskier asset class. 10 years ago, it would have been a straight no. No way. People aren't ready for this. There's not enough access to information. There's not enough transparency, whatever else.
Indeed, yeah.
And so, but now there is, right? I mean, we point to Shark Tank all the time, right? People understand how this stuff works. They see how deals are made. They see that it's risky, whatever else, right? And then with the Jobs Act and other things that have happened, at least in the United States, there is more accessibility for a regular person to invest directly in a company that you couldn't have done 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, you couldn't have done it. So those three elements have really come together to make a perfect storm
yeah.
for us to be able to do this when we couldn't have done it even 5 years ago.
But do you think that makes the United States sort of uniquely positioned for your product? Because it's not clear to me that it's directly, you know, applicable to, say, Europe or Asia. Mm-hmm. Do you have any mm-hmm. sense of how you're going to be perceived outside of the US? I don't know where you're trying to market this to, but mm-hmm. presumably you've given it 10 seconds of thought.
Yeah, we looked at it. I mean, you know, selfishly and strategically, I mean, the US is just such a big market and
yeah,
there's so much, you know, disposable income here that this is by far the best place that we could ever launch something like this, you know, from a probability and likelihood of success kind of standpoint. But, you know, me, I mean, I personally have a huge interest in being able to take it outside the United States.
Sure, of course.
The thing that we've pursued and explored, I should say, probably just explored the most is how we can open it up for non-US residents to be able to invest into it, right? So in the same way that a non-US resident could, you know, make trades on the New York Stock Exchange, you know, how can we do that, but with Sweater's fund structure for someone that lives in the UK or someone that lives in Ukraine or someone that lives in Japan?
Sure.
And our understanding is that we can do that. We have to go through approval processes with every country that we want to make the offering in. So every country is different.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, there are specific regulations everywhere that we would want to open it up to. So, of course, that opens up all kinds of questions to...
Yeah, the EU is not treated as one market for this purpose?
I don't know about the EU in this instance. From a finance perspective and, you know, a personal finance regulatory perspective, my guess is probably it's not a blanket. That's my guess. It's not going to be you know, like crossing borders with products, you know, and how they've opened that up.
Sure.
I think it's going to be much more strict, personally. But I haven't looked deep enough to know.
Yeah, and you know, the Robin Hood analogy is an interesting one because the thing, and I think Coinbase is another good example if we're talking about cryptocurrency trading. It strikes me that one of the interesting things about those apps is that you can instantly see in real time, effectively, how your investment is doing. But VC doesn't really work that way. In fact, typically you wouldn't know, I guess, for years how you're... And presumably, I guess, is your idea that you can post some financial analysis every quarter or you don't have that sort of instant kind of interaction that I guess you would have with trading stocks, for example?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And without diving into, I guess, details I can't divulge yet around how we are navigating through the SEC regulatory framework, you know, the basic idea is that there are touch points when you can ascertain how much the portfolio is worth. So if you just look at, let's just talk about a traditional VC fund for a second, and then I'll tell you the difference.
Sure.
So in a traditional VC fund, you know, you've got usually, you know, 1 to 4 called general partners who are venture capitalists, right? They're the ones looking at the deal flow, making decisions, all that kind of stuff. They're managing the fund. Those, you know, call it, let's just say 2 GPs have a whole list of, you know, probably 50 to 100 LPs that are limited partners that actually invest into the fund.
Sure.
And it's that pool of money that the VCs are actually investing into companies. So between those two groups, they have the GP group, the VCs have to report back to their investors on what's happening in the portfolio. They usually do it quarterly. Some only do it once a year. But effectively, the way that they look at the portfolio is they say, okay, we've been operating for 3 years. We've made 15 investments. Here are the 15 investments. This is the starting valuation of each of those investments and what our holding was in each of them, which implies how much our particular position is worth in that company. Since that point in time, they have raised one or two rounds or three rounds of additional funding, and their valuation has gone from valuation A on day one to now valuation B on day, 785, right? And our position in that period of time has tripled. So, and this, and these three companies has tripled, these five have doubled, and these two actually failed and have gone out of business, right? And over the course of the entire life of the fund, you can play that game of valuing each individual investment based on their last fundraising point in time, or based on success or failure. Success being they either IPO'd or were acquired for a certain amount, or they failed and the investment goes to zero. So you can get a feel for that at any point in time.
Sure.
But also at any point in time, the day following a report, a company could fail, right, and drop out. Or a company could get acquired for 10x revenues the next day and totally build a portfolio out of the water in a good way.
Yeah.
So sure, it kind of goes either way, but it is messier, right? And it is only done, quarterly or whatever. So generally that's how a typical VC fund works. Ours will be a little bit different because we'll use the same kind of data points, but our ultimate objective is to really create the index fund of startups, of private companies, is really what our long game is. So, we want, instead of having 30 companies in the portfolio, we want 300 and eventually 3,000, right?
Okay, gotcha.
So over the course of 10 or 20 years, right, then we're going to have a very different portfolio makeup and many more data points that will smooth that whole process out.
Yep.
And we will get to a point where we are probably valuing the portfolio on a daily basis. So you can actually go in and feel what's happening today and how is it different from yesterday.
Sure. Yeah, I got it. Okay. Oh, that's very interesting. And so it sounds like in general, you think I assume you have a pretty positive outlook on Sweater, but VC in general, are they going to have to adapt to your model, do you think? Or do you think that there's the sort of the way of doing VC is still going to continue? Do you see that changing a lot? I mean, what's your outlook on the industry?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be presumptuous and say that anyone's going to adapt to us anytime soon. I mean, this is a big, well-established market with a lot of very big players. And to make a dent in it, I think would take a decade, maybe even two decades to really change the face of it. Robinhood was able to change the face of that, the public market, retail trader world in 3 to 5 years, but it's also much faster moving and they have fewer barriers to, I guess, acquiring customers and making change that way. I mean, I would love to disrupt the VC market. Now, make no doubt about it. I think that there's tons of inefficiency. I think there are a lot of investors that shouldn't be investors.
Sure.
I think that the model is inherently very biased for the investors as opposed to being for the entrepreneurs. And I would love to see changes in that.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, I'd love to see a change, but I don't know that I can guarantee it either. So we'll see, right?
Fair enough. Well, you're doing some pretty interesting things at Sweater. I noticed one of the things you're doing, and please tell us where we can find you online, but also tell us, what is it you're doing? I saw you had sent me an email about some sort of weekly video pitches. You want to talk about that?
Oh yeah. So yeah, it's called Founder Saga, and it's a virtual summit that is going to go from, it starts on November 18th and goes through the end of 2021. It's kind of like a mix between a podcast that happens every week, right?
Okay.
And is usually pre-recorded, and a virtual summit, which is done virtually with video, but it's live.
Oh, okay.
So these are going to be live, like stage interviews, like you would see in person at a conference, right? So like a live stage interview.
Sure.
They're going to happen every Wednesday, starting November 18th and going through the end of 2021. So we've got our first cohort that's already up and running. We've got about 25 founders as part of that, and it will take us through the end of January. And we are recruiting the second cohort as we speak. But the founders are awesome. I mean, we've had founders. I think there's three or four founders that have raised over $200 million. We've got a handful that have sold companies for over $100 million. The bare minimum to be interviewed on the stage is have raised at least $10 million in venture capital or bootstrapped to at least $5 million or more. So all of the founders meet those requirements regardless. But the whole purpose of it is it really kind of gets into sort of some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, which is the early stage, navigating the earliest stage of the business, which is going from the back of the napkin to when you get your first outside funding. How do you survive that period? Because more companies fail during that period than any other time.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
And so it's very much undocumented. There are a few things like the Lean Startup that try to give you a formula to get through it, But if there's one thing I've learned, it's that there is no formula, right?
Yep.
So what we're trying to extract is talk to founders who have successfully made it through that, and not just to their first funding event, but through multiple funding events, and or at least success from a revenue perspective, and look back at it and say, what did you do to survive that, right? How did you survive financially? How did you get your first product built when you didn't have any money? You know, what was your co-founder story? You know, was there drama there? How did you set that whole framework up in order to get to success? You know, all that kind of stuff is the kind of topics we're going to dive into and document A, how hard it is, and make sure that that's, you know, that people have realistic expectations.
Yep.
But B, the hope that you can get through it too. And that this is what smart people did to make it through the other side.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's so critical because I think sometimes people get discouraged when they hit a roadblock in their entrepreneurial adventures, and then they never pick it up because they've just become maybe too jaded by the experience or whatever.
Mm-hmm. No, it's totally true. You know, it's important that founders have correct expectations. My belief is that all unhappiness stems from unmet expectations. And so when you're reading Crunchbase or, you know, you're reading whatever on the news, or TechCrunch, you know, and you're reading the news, all you ever see is the good stuff. You hear about the outliers, you know, the guys that raised $50 million in a seed round after operating for 3 months, and, you know, crazy stuff that just, it's not normal.
Indeed.
And so founders, they get all up about how exciting it is being a founder, and it's all very sexy right now, but very few are talking about how hard it really is. And not to discourage anyone, but to say, hey, if you're going to do this, know that it's going to be hard. Swallow that pill before you get into it. And know that you're going to have to surround yourself with very smart people in order to make it through the other side. It's kind of like an endurance event, you know? And if you go into it with that mentality, you're going to be far more likely to make it out the other side than you go in with, you know, big eyes and, you know, just excited to be a founder, and you tell all your friends, and then you get punched in the face a few times by reality and quit. You know, that's not good for you. It's not good for anybody else.
Yeah. I can echo that. And certainly, especially that having a good team around you is absolutely critical. Hard to do much of anything if you don't have great people with you.
It's the truth.
Finally, Jesse, tell us where we can find you online.
Sure. I mean, personally, you know, my central life is on LinkedIn. So everybody can find me on LinkedIn. You just search my name. I don't think there's too many Jesse Randalls out there.
I'll put the link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, that'd be great. So that's me personally. I mean, the companies that I'm running, you can find Sweater at sweaterventures.com. Founder Saga, which is really a derivative of Sweater, is found at summit.foundersaga.com, where you could, you know, sign up for that event if you feel it's a good fit for you. And then Guidely is located at guidely.com.
Well, I think we'll leave it there. Jesse Randall, thanks so much for your time. I wish you all the best.
Thanks. Pleasure being here, Sean.
Listeners, that will do it for another edition of the Euro Digital Partners Insights podcast. Find our articles on the web at eurodigitalpartners.com/insights. And to comment or suggest guests and topics for future episodes, email us at info@eurodigitalpartners.com. Be sure to like Euro Digital Partners on Facebook and follow EDP on Twitter. We're there at EU Digital P. Finally, please leave a 5-star review for us on iTunes and wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. Lastly, be sure to head over to beatyourcompetitiononline.com to get enrolled in the best and most practical digital marketing course on the internet. So that's it. Thanks again for subscribing. I'm Sean Patterson with Jesse Randall. Bye-bye.